The following program is produced by the University of Florida's School of Journalism and Communications under a grant from the National Educational Television and Radio Center in cooperation with the National Association of Educational Broadcasters. The University of Florida presents The United States and Latin America, Part 1, the 10th in a series of recorded documentary reports on the contemporary revolution in Latin America. Your reporter is the distinguished American journalist and editor of the Christian Science Monitor, Irwin D. Canham.
In today's world, the need for the United States to maintain favorable relations with the 20 Latin American republics is never seriously challenged. In trade and investment, Latin America stands head and shoulder above the rest of the world in importance to the United States. Two-way trade reaches over $8 billion annually. American private investment has passed the $9 billion mark, while our government has invested more than $2.5 billion in this region. But perhaps of even more significance is the strategic value of Latin America in the Cold War. Herbert L. Matthews of the New York Times has described this region as a world at our doorstep on which, to a considerable degree, we depend for our existence as a world power. If we were deprived of the raw materials of the area or its markets, continues Matthews, our economy and our security would be gravely, perhaps vitally, affected. Matthews warns us, it is an area where no hostile power can be allowed to gain a foothold, for, strategically, this is our soft underbelly. The biting criticism and the anti-Yankee-ism leveled by Latin Americans at the United States, as reported in almost every day's press, is certainly not a new development in our long search for a workable Latin American policy. Indeed, Latin Americans have viewed the United States as a colossus of the North for more than a century and a half. Throughout most of the 19th century and well into the 20th century, much of Latin American literature, including poetry, has been directed against the United States and its policies. Surprisingly enough, however, our relations with Latin America got off to a fairly good start. The United States was the first outside nation to recognize these newly established republics as they fought for and won their independence from Spain, Portugal, and France. The United States, a very young nation, still struggling to maintain its newly won independence, very quickly discovered the strategic importance of this region to its security. In December 1823, we issued a foreign policy statement that has since become known as the Monroe Doctrine. It was conceived by then Secretary of State John Quincy Adams and delivered as part of President James Monroe's message to Congress. The essence of the doctrine is contained in this one sentence, directed toward European powers.
We owe it, therefore, to candor and to the amicable relations existing between the United States and those powers to declare that we should consider any attempt on their part to extend their system to any portion of this hemisphere as dangerous to our peace and security.
The initial reaction of Latin America to the Monroe Doctrine was anything but favorable. Many students of hemispheric affairs see in the doctrine one of the first stumbling blocks in our historically troubled relations with Latin America.
When the Monroe Doctrine was proclaimed in 1823, there was comment all over the Western Hemisphere, as well as all over the world, of course, about what our objectives were. And it didn't take the Latin Americans long to realize that we were trying to do something that they didn't quite understand, and it made them suspicious of us immediately. And the Monroe Doctrine has tended to make them continue in their suspicion of us over the years.
Director of the University of Florida School of Inter-American Studies, Dr. A. Curtis Wilgus, discussed the early effects of the Monroe Doctrine with a faculty member.
I think, Dr. Wister, you, as professor of history, have a number of comments to make on this early period in the 19th century, because it was such a critical period.
Well, Dr. Wilgus, I think in part the reaction, the initial reaction against the Monroe Doctrine was based upon disappointment.
Dr. Donald Worcester, editor of the Hispanic American Historical Review.
During the Latin American Wars of Independence, the Latin Americans anticipated and hoped for substantial aid from the United States, but no official aid was forthcoming. It's true that men like Henry Clay spoke strongly in favor of assisting Latin America, and statues of him have appeared in various of the Latin American countries, but the United States was not in a position to help anyone militarily or economically. Basically, this was an attempt to guarantee the security of the United States and nothing more. It was a unilateral doctrine, as is the case with most of the major aspects of any nation's foreign policy. Later on, later presidents interpreted the Monroe Doctrine in manners to make it possible for them to carry out policies which may not have affected directly Western Hemisphere security.
One of those later presidents with a new interpretation for the Monroe Doctrine was Theodore Roosevelt. His Roosevelt corollary ushered in an age of protective imperialism and dollar diplomacy.
One of the things that we insisted on at that time was pretty much the sanctity of American investments.
Professor of Latin American economics at the University of Florida, Robert Bradbury, explains the meaning of the Roosevelt corollary.
And one of the modifications of the Monroe Doctrine was the Roosevelt corollary, that if we said under the Monroe Doctrine that a European nation could not intervene in Latin American affairs, we were morally responsible to be the collecting agency for bad debts where a Latin American nation refused to pay. This led, in the 20th century, to our sending Marines into Central American republics and into Haiti and Santo Domingo in order to collect debts. Also, this increase in our economic interest in Latin America, and as a result of the war with Spain, our acquisition of territories overseas, caused us to be interested in the construction of the Panama Canal.
The Panama Canal episode is unanimously agreed upon in both North and South America as one of the truly black pages in American history. There is no doubt that the United States intervened in the Panamanian revolt against Colombia, that we prevented Colombian troops from landing there. Dr. Worcester comments on Theodore Roosevelt's role.
Hasty Teddy said that it was his policy to speak softly or walk softly and carry a big stick. And this sounded amusing at first, but after the Panama affair, it was no longer amusing. The treaty we signed with Panama after Panamanian independence was probably the most rapid action of this sort ever taken by the United States. And this is one of the things which caused some eyebrows to be raised with regard to our part in the whole affair.
It has been written that our intervention in Panama, what with our diplomatic, legal, and financial manipulations, is something that most Americans wish they could forget, without, of course, losing the canal. This episode, as well as other interventions in Mexico, Cuba, Haiti, Dominican Republic, and Nicaragua, have left a legacy of mistrust that still exists in Latin America. By the 1920s, this kind of imperialism did not sit comfortably with the American people. Besides, we had emerged as a stronger nation after World War I, and a sense of security came over the nation. The Kellogg-Briand Pact in 1928, outlawing war, removed the power, at least designed to outlaw war, removed the possibility of European intervention in Latin America on paper. And so the stage was set for the good neighbor policy. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was not the first American statesman to use this famous phrase. Over a century before, Secretary of State Henry Clay had used it to describe his Latin American policy. President Lincoln used the phrase good neighborhood in a message to the Senate in 1862. President-elect Herbert Hoover, in a goodwill tour through Latin America, promised the Latins that his administration would act as a good neighbor. But it remained for FDR to give the phrase eloquence as well as application.
In the field of world policy, I would dedicate this nation to the policy of the good neighbor. The neighbor who resolutely respects himself, and because he does so, respects the rights of others. The neighbor who respects his obligations and respects the sanctity of his agreement in and with a world of neighbors.
This is Jules Dubois, Latin American correspondent of the Chicago Tribune. The good neighbor policy did bring a smile and communication to Latin America, the famous FDR smile, and his communication. He talked to them regularly and sent emissaries around. But the precursor of that good neighbor policy was Herbert Hoover. He's the one who started it rolling, and FDR, in his inaugural address, gave it a name and impetus. The Latin Americans love slogans. They buy slogans as easily as they buy lottery tickets. And if we can promote a good slogan and back it up with some effective measures, then we've got it made.
World War II had ended, and as far as Latin America was concerned, so had the good neighbor policy. For before long, the Cold War and the Marshall Plan established a new focus for United States policy. Faced with the immediate danger of the economic and political collapse of Western Europe, the United States responded in 1948 with the introduction of the Marshall Plan. This massive aid program excluded our southern neighbors. Consequently, Latin American dreams of a continuing wartime industrial boom and prosperity were cruelly shattered. One of the most consistent complaints heard in Latin America is that ever since VJ Day, this region has been neglected by Washington.
Norteamericana.
A Colombian businessman and former diplomat describes this neglect to a group of American newsmen and tells of Colombia's hope for the future.
Considerando que los países latinoamericanos son también importantes para los Estados Unidos,
they hope and they believe that the new administration will integrate the American economy in terms of recognizing that the Latin American countries are also very important for the United States, and that consequently they will not concentrate help as has been done in the past on the countries of Europe and the East, on those countries outside the communist orbit in those areas, but will recognize that the Latin Americans, and particularly the Colombians, have been faithful friends and allies, and feel very bad about having been in the last place in relation to programs not only of help but of mutual cooperation in terms of global defense.
Certainly the dissatisfaction with United States policies in Latin America has been deeply rooted in economics. The post-war world had created new problems for our sister republics. During the war, because of United States's great need for their raw materials and the unavailability of many imports from other parts of the world, Latin America accumulated almost $4.5 billion in gold and foreign exchange holdings. Then, in the wake of post-war inflation, the Latin American nations stood helplessly by as the purchasing power of their dollar reserves dwindled. The Truman administration removed domestic price ceilings. The price of many products which the Latin Americans needed rose sharply. Studies show that Peru, for example, was forced to pay more than twice as much for household appliances, automobiles, and radios as it previously paid before the war. In addition, Latin Americans somehow felt the United States responsible for the chronic fluctuations in the prices paid for their own basic export products, coffee, metals, cotton, bananas. Technically known as the instability of commodity prices, this condition has non-technical effects that the entire population feels: the pinching of the pocketbook, the tightening of the trouser belt. Latin Americans see themselves caught in the center of a large pair of economic scissors. One blade represents the depressed prices of their commodity products. The other blade is the steadily increasing costs of imports, mostly from the United States. The dean of a medical school near Cali, Colombia, told us of the effect on coffee growers in his country when the price of coffee on the world market dropped nearly 50% in less than 5 years.
That means that those families, those coffee growers, are receiving for the same effort half of what they were receiving 5 years ago. And they are importing goods from the States at about 40% more probably the cost, because farming equipment, machinery, and all the things that we need had been slowly going up in price. And our money is going down. So really, these people are receiving about 25% of what they were receiving 5 years ago for the same effort. That tends to create bad feelings, of course.
During most of the post-war period, when aid was forthcoming from the United States, it was rather likely to be military aid. This may have pleased the Latin American militarist, but it certainly built up resentment on the part of those citizens who were trying to raise their country's level of living. Men like Dr. Gabriel Velasquez, former Minister of Public Health and past Director of Education in the Department of Valle in Colombia, who has this to say.
Official aid in the past years, with some exceptions, was for military aid. I remember an anecdote about 4 or 5 years ago, while we were struggling in requesting money for improving education, health, even in loans, I was invited to see a demonstration of 8 of the new jets that were given a very low price to our government. And one of the military attachés proudly came to me and said, "What do you think of this beautiful jet given for such a small price?" And I said, "Well, I dream of 8 universities that I can build with the same amount of money. Each of those was about $1 million.
United States military aid to Latin America was part of our program to arm our friends in the struggle against communism. This had been the chief concern of our foreign policy since 1947, when President Truman said, in effect, that we would have to defend ourselves at great distances rather than waiting to meet a communist threat on our beaches. A direct result of this exclusively anti-communist policy was the support and the appearance of support which we gave to cruel, corrupt dictators. By professing to be anti-communist, dictators such as Batista in Cuba, Trujillo in the Dominican Republic, Perón in Argentina, Somoza in Nicaragua, Pérez Jiménez in Venezuela, these men, despised by their people, were able to secure the favor of the United States. Even as late as December 1960, a noted Latin American advocate of democracy, José Figueres, could berate an American audience for embracing dictators.
The United States have had too much complacency, too much connivance with regimes that were hated with the people. And the United States has overlooked Latin America in this terrible attitude of not knowing what is going on, of not making any distinction between a democratic movement and a dictatorial one, in not knowing who the leaders were, in not knowing what's going on, who wants honest reform, honest and democratic social movement, and who is what.
I think that the purpose of the United States in doing this, that is maintaining dictators, is to keep Latin America from communism.
Mario Ariet, a Cuban exile attending the University of Florida. His is typical of student opinion throughout Latin America.
But I would say that that just creates resentments on the part of the Latin American countries. I could cite, for instance, the example of Nicaragua, where the sons of a former dictator Somoza are now dictators of the country. This former dictator Somoza was set in power by the United States. And they live in a hill, which it's on top of the city of Managua, the capital of Nicaragua. And this hill is all surrounded by tanks and military force. And the only other building besides the residence of the Somozas is the United States Embassy, which is inside that military fence they have. So that creates an identification between the dictators, which are hated by the people, and the United States. And naturally, when those dictators are overthrown, then the natural reaction of the people is against the United States and toward the only other leading country in the world, namely Russia or communism.
Another factor helping to create a climate of anti-Americanism was the failure of many Latin Americans to make a distinction between American businessmen and the United States government. A few horrible examples among the many shining ones in our business community operating in Latin America gave the United States a black eye difficult to live down.
In general, the ill feelings come from a mutual lack of understanding.
Observations from a Chilean-born assistant editor of the McGraw-Hill trade magazine Industria, Sergio Gazitua.
Generally, the Americans who are sent to Latin America do not know the language, nor do they make much of an attempt to learn it while they arrive there. The Americans are usually sent on short-time assignments without a proper orientation program here in the United States before they go down there.
Investment of dollars in Brazil has taken on a form which is not very healthy.
Criticism from one of Brazil's most successful businessmen and industrialists, Antonio Byington.
A company could come to Brazil, especially after the Second World War, when the United States had practically a monopoly on world trade and the ability to deliver manufactured goods, and practically make the profit which it wanted to make. And inasmuch as the Sherman antitrust laws do not go beyond the boundaries of the United States, this enabled certain American firms to get together on the local market, as they probably did in all foreign countries, and have a different set of rules for their foreign business from what they had in their domestic company.
A Brazilian director of Willis Overland of Brazil tells us what sort of American company his country would welcome and what kind should stay out.
It is only a question of confidence and the firm proposal of coming to establish an industry and not a fly-by-night outfit to come and make a quick profit and get the hell out.
We've been listening to the nature of the resentment Latin Americans had against our foreign policy. A resentment that had been building up under both the Truman and Eisenhower administrations. These were the widespread feelings of Latin Americans in the spring of 1958, when Vice President Richard M. Nixon set off for a goodwill tour of South America. Was the State Department aware of how Latin America felt? The time, 2 months before the Nixon trip. The scene, hearing room of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. The questioner, Senator William Fulbright, Democrat of Arkansas. Do you believe, Mr. Rubottom, that there is widespread discontent in Latin America with the United States policies? Answer, from Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs, Roy R. Rubottom. No, sir, I do not.
No one in Washington realized clearly how deep the resentment was against United States policy when Vice President Richard Nixon took off on an 18-day tour of Latin America this spring. But it began to show early in the trip.
Correspondent Wells Church, who accompanied Nixon, reporting his observations later that year over CBS radio.
We noticed that in Uruguay, in Argentina, Paraguay, and Bolivia, the crowds were quite cool and the Latin reporters' questions sometimes hostile. And in Lima, Peru, the first demonstrations broke out. The vice president was stoned and spat upon. The violence reached a crescendo when Mr. Nixon arrived in Caracas, the capital of Venezuela. There, the vice president's car was rushed by the mob, which was obviously led by communist and communist sympathizers. They threw rocks, shattering the limousine's glass windows, and Mr. Nixon's very life was in danger. And afterward, he told reporters what went through his mind at that very moment.
My thoughts were with regard, what are you going to do in the next minute, the next 5 minutes? You don't think in terms of world politics and hemispheric problems. But somebody is banging on your window.
The vice president also expressed a philosophy that must guide the United States in its relations with countries of Latin and South America.
One rule we must never forget. In international relations, as well as in political or business affairs, is that we must never take our friends for granted. What we must get across there, as well as in other parts of the world, is this very simple message, that we, the government, the people of the United States, want for other peoples just what we have for ourselves. Independence for our country, freedom for our people, and the greatest possibilities for economic progress that can be devised.
One of the repercussions of the entire affair was a sweeping study of our relations with our neighbors to the south and a reappraisal of the aid programs we sponsor in Latin America. Some of the changes resulting from the hard look we were forced to take at ourselves as a result of the attacks on Vice President Nixon are certain to have an effect reaching long into the future.
Looking at the Nixon trip with all the advantage that comes with hindsight, it's now possible to say it gave our Latin American policy a new direction. As a direct result of his jolting experience, Mr. Nixon came to a number of reasonable conclusions and policy ideas. One was a new formula for handling dictators, a cool handshake, leaving the embrace, the abrazo, for our democratic friends. Mr. Nixon believed a widespread misunderstanding of our motives existed in Latin America. He believed that our diplomats were woefully out of tune with Latin American opinion because of too much contact with the elite, not enough contact with the political opposition, labor leaders, the people. He believed that we should try to do something about protecting these nations from wild fluctuations of prices paid for their basic export products. And finally, he believed the United States should assert its democratic leadership more vigorously in Latin America in order to stem the tide of communism's rising appeal. Mr. Nixon felt if the trip had called attention of our government and our people to the pressing problems of Latin America, then it was well worth those agonizing moments in Caracas. Next week's program will examine the evolution of our current Latin American policy.
The United States and Latin America, Part 1, is the 10th in a series of weekly documentary reports on the contemporary revolution in Latin America. The program is narrated by the distinguished journalist and editor of the Christian Science Monitor, Irwin D. Cannon. The series is produced in cooperation with the University of Florida's School of Inter-American Studies. You may receive without charge the text of today's program by writing this station. Today's report was based in part on material appearing in the publication The United States and Latin America, published by the American Assembly, Columbia University. This program was prepared and recorded by Will Lewis for Radio Center, School of Journalism and Communications, University of Florida, Gainesville, under a grant from the National Educational Television and Radio Center, and is being distributed by the National Association of Educational Broadcasters. This is the NAEB Radio Network.